right, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to American Security Project. My name is Matthew Wallen. I'm the Fellow for Public Diplomacy here. I'm also running our new program on U.S.-Russia relations. If you haven't been here, or you're not familiar with ASP, we were founded back in 2005, 2006 by a number of senators you may have heard of, John Kerry, Chuck Hagel, Gary Hart, and Warren Rudman. And they formed us to look at a variety of national security issues, some of which we don't always think of in that way, things like climate change, energy, public diplomacy, a bunch of various other topics that you can check out on our website. We're looking at all sorts of new things this year, including Cuba and Russia, like I mentioned. So we're looking at these from a nonpartisan perspective. We've got a board of fine retired flag officers, business leaders, Democrats, and Republicans. So we keep to the bipartisan and nonpartisan nature to the best of our ability. Today, we are going to talk about the issues regarding nuclear weapons that we face today. And I think we live in a time where we all have questions about where that's going. In recent weeks, we've heard a number of statements and seen a number of actions. We've seen Russia violate the INF Treaty, and this is something we've been keeping an eye on for several years now. But they've now deployed basically two battalions of cruise missiles into the region. We've also seen the president make a number of statements that we're not quite sure how to gauge, recently stating that the U.S. nuclear arsenal should be at the top of the pack. I would argue that it already is at the top of the pack. So trying to figure out what that means with regards to weapons capacity, as he has mentioned, we are all eager to find out. But I'm going to resurrect the ghost of Ronald Reagan here for a moment to state that when we're talking about nuclear weapons, in the 1984 State of the Union, Reagan himself said, "A nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought. The only value in our two nations," then referring to the Soviet Union, "possessing nuclear weapons is to make sure they will never be used." And I think wiser words have never been spoken. So to discuss some of the issues we have going on today, we have some distinguished panelists. We have Colonel Guy Roberts to my right. He is first and foremost a Marine, having served over 25 years in the Corps. He's currently an independent consultant on national security and nonproliferation issues, and I believe is teaching at University of Mary Washington nowadays, also a senior associate at CSIS. Until August 2011, he was a Deputy Assistant Secretary General for Weapons of Mass Destruction Policy for NATO, where he was responsible for developing policy on combating the proliferation of WMDs, missile defense, and overseeing and implementing NATO's nuclear deterrence policy and posture. To his right, we have Olya Oleker. She's a senior advisor and director for Russia and the Russia and Eurasia program at CSIS. Her recent research has focused on military, political, economic, and social development in countries in transition, particularly Russia, Ukraine, and the Central Asian and Caucasian successor states to the Soviet Union. Prior to joining CSIS, she's held a number of senior posts at the RAND Corporation, most recently as RAND's director of Russia and RAND Center for Russia and Eurasia. And she's also a distinguished publisher in a number of other outlets, including the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, CNN, and U.S. News and World Report. And to her right, we have Dr. Anya Lukyanova-Fink. She's a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the RAND Corporation. Her research examines Russian views on nuclear escalation and risks. Prior to that, she was a program officer at the Stanley Foundation, where she focused on nuclear material security issues and brought together stakeholders involved in the nuclear security summits. Between 2007 and 2012, she's a research associate on Russian nuclear weapons and fuel cycles at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. So with that, our panelists will each speak for about 5 to 10 minutes or so. I might ask a few questions after that, and then we'll turn it over to all of you in the audience to ask what's on your mind. So with that, Colonel Roberts.
Thank you very much, Matt. It's a real pleasure to be here, and given the fact that we only have 5 to 10 minutes, I will touch on some what I consider to be important and critical points, and obviously with my background being from NATO, I will be focusing primarily on the situation in NATO and some issues in that regard. You didn't mention that I'm also a lawyer, and as we used to often say, in fact, one of my English colleagues at NATO would say often that, nuclear weapons are a lot like lawyers. When one side has them, the other side wants them. When they're launched, they can never be recalled, and when they land, they screw everything up forever. So I'll try not to do that. But certainly what we've seen over when I left NATO in 2011 is a really dramatic change in the security environment. a security environment that is really drastically more dangerous and recognized to be so by the alliance. And probably the most visible and active threat or challenge is, of course, Russian capabilities and the Russian aggression that has been demonstrated by, first of all, in 2008 and taking territory from Georgia, and then, of course, subsequently annexing Crimea. And if there's anything that our NATO allies get upset about more than anything else is a violation of international law. And certainly, as the categories of violations that we've seen with Russia, not only the annexation of Crimea, the hybrid warfare they're conducting against Ukraine, their violation of the NATO-Russia Founding Act, and many, many other documents that have demonstrated that they are indeed a nation that doesn't respect international law, and that's a significant point for our allies. The alliance's strategic concept document that was created in 2010 with the heads of state and government all agreed, characterized Russia, the NATO-Russia relationship as a strong and constructive partnership based on mutual confidence, transparency, and predictability. Well, that is no longer the case. And in response to all the things I just described at the 2016 Warsaw Summit, NATO reaffirmed the fact that they had we have the capability and resolve to impose on any adversary unacceptable costs which would far outweigh any expected benefits. The United States maintains what we call non-strategic nuclear weapons in Europe, and their emphasis now is on, and I'll speak a little bit more about that in a minute, to enhance that capability as part of the overall NATO deterrence posture. Again, in 2012, when we reviewed our deterrence posture, the alliance made it clear that the mix of nuclear capabilities we have today is sound, appropriate, and then it must rightly be perceived as credible, effective, and capable of conducting nuclear operations if deterrence fails. The so-called deterrence and defense posture review recognized and endorsed the need and importance of burden sharing within the alliance. Now, this is a concept that many people aren't aware of, and the fact is that our NATO allies participate in the nuclear mission. In fact, up to 16 nations are could potentially fly the mission with what we call dual-capable aircraft, which are currently primarily F-16s that will be subsequently replaced by the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35. And this is part of a demonstration of the alliance's cohesion and resolve. This use of the so-called dual-capable aircraft clearly and visibly demonstrate the alliance cohesion, and it provides, in addition, of course, a conventional capability. And that is an integral part of ensuring by the United States that we will come to their defense. One foreign British defense minister a long time ago once said that it takes 5% of our nuclear capability to deter the Russians and 95% to reassure our allies. And many times that seems to be the case. In fact, in 2003, when seven nations joined the alliance, every single one of them said in their admission to the NATO is that a critical element of that is the nuclear umbrella provided by the United States. Now, the U.S. certainly faces a nuclear landscape that is very complex, uncertain, and with a great deal of risk. And there's a whole set of nuclear dangers that the alliance, as well as the United States, needs to look at. These include, of course, a nuclear attack by a nuclear-armed state, a growing nuclear intimidation and coercion by regional powers, a renewed nuclear competition among the great powers, which we've seen with the buildup of nuclear capabilities by Russia and China, the risk of nuclear intimidation and the use of nuclear weapons by terrorists or non-state actors, and of course, strategic uncertainty. And the strategic uncertainty is a reason we maintain the stockpile and nuclear capabilities that we do. I remember very well former Secretary Gates making a statement about our ability to predict things in the international community. And he said, quote, when it comes to predicting the nature and location of our next military engagement, since Vietnam, our record has been perfect. We have never once gotten it right. Grenada, Panama, Somalia, the Balkans, Haiti, Kuwait, Iraq, and more. We had no idea that we were going to be engaged in those kinds of events. So what are the kind of things that we can do? Again, I just want to emphasize that U.S. nuclear presence in Europe does play a vital assurance role for both our allies and our adversaries. And current NATO sharing arrangements for U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe serve three functions. They communicate to adversaries that an alliance nuclear deterrent has been constituted with multiple allies involved in consulting on policy, maintaining the posture and preparing for possible operations. It assures the allies of the credibility of U.S. commitments, and again, that assurance is made less by just political statements and more by the presence of the weapons, the delivery systems, the consultations that we do with our allies, and that's a critical point of the indivisibility of the alliance. And any potential use of nuclear weapons, the U.S. has agreed that we will consult with our allies first. The financial and other concrete, tangible arrangements, and then finally, that the U.S., while bearing the full burden of extended deterrence, the allies have also assumed practical security roles, financial costs, and political and military risks and responsibilities. The U.S., in partnership with its NATO allies, of course, given the increased threat, needs to challenge, deter, and if necessary, defeat these threats that are lurking within the so-called sphere of arc of instability on the periphery of NATO's borders. How to do that? Well, suggest several things. First, need to address the nuclear and conventional capability shortfalls and bolster defense spending to restore and enhance NATO's deterrence credibility. Already, we have increased the readiness rate for our nuclear deterrent by 2 weeks. Second, strategic and clear communications essential for effective deterrence, assurance, and crisis management. The new strategic environment requires clear, unambiguous statements regarding NATO's resolve, something we've fallen down on, although the Warsaw Summit statement was very strong, one of the strongest I've seen in decades, actually. And regarding NATO's resolve, intent when confronted with coercion, intimidation, and threats. The U.S. should work with NATO to develop a coordinated deterrent communication strategy. That's something else that is missing, and which we seem to be reluctant to actually discuss the NATO deterrence posture. We also need to educate and inform our publics. The narrative can't be captured by just the unilateral disarmament crowd and its agenda. Third, U.S. leadership in bolstering alliance deterrence policy and posture is essential. These actions will also affect the credibility of U.S. extended deterrent to allies outside of NATO. Public education throughout the alliance on the need and importance of nuclear deterrence remains critical. We need to send a strong message that in today's security environment, reducing the roles of nuclear weapons is no longer viable for the foreseeable future. Fourth, we need a review of NATO's readiness categories and deployment policies. This would include military planning and command capability, the actual basing and dual capable aircraft tasks, including hosting exercises. And we're looking at that, the alliance is looking at that today. As I said before, we've increased the readiness by 2 weeks, and we're looking at doing more overt exercises. And finally, the U.S. needs to work with its alliance partners to address how the burden sharing can be broadened to include all 29 NATO members, soon to be 29. As I mentioned, 16 nations actively participate in the burden sharing, but many of the countries, especially the small countries, don't have a role and don't have the capability. I suggested that they spend $25 million and buy a D5 missile for SLBMs, and we could put an Estonian bumper sticker on it or something like that, but that didn't go over very well for some reason. So I know I'm out of time, so I will close with that, but just wanted to, again, reemphasize that very important nuclear posture of the NATO alliance that's been critical to the alliance and the indivisibility of the alliance and the assurance to our allies, but more so and the importance, the critical importance of U.S. leadership. I really can't emphasize that enough, and let me just, again, close with a quote from the Secretary General of NATO, who, when asked about how important it is to have the American presence in Europe, said this: "If there is doubt about the American leadership, the result will be stronger foes, weaker friends, and a more insecure world. We've seen results with the, quote, lead from behind, close quote. Strong, proactive U.S. leadership will result in stronger, more capable allies, lessening the need for the U.S. to expend blood and treasure to defend them." And with that, I'll close. I think I was on time, hopefully.
Yeah, we're good.
Good.
Olya.
All right. So thank you to the American Security Project for having us here. Thank you all for being here. I've been asked to talk about how Russia looks at its nuclear weapons. Disclaimer, I'm not Russian. I'm an American who studies Russia, among other things. So, I get this by listening to what the Russians say, reading what they write, and looking at what they deploy and build. So, a couple of things I want to highlight to start with. Nuclear weapons play a number of roles in Russian policy and force posture, just as they do in the policy and force posture of other nuclear weapon states. They are very critically an important reminder to everyone around the world and in Russia of Russia's great power role and its equality, at least in this area, with the United States. They're a tool of deterrence, importantly, against a large-scale U.S. nuclear attack. We don't think about this because we think we're not planning to launch a large-scale nuclear attack on Russia. But we also are perfectly happy to talk about capability rather than intent in other circumstances. And when the Russians put that back at us, they feel that, yes, they need to have a nuclear arsenal to keep the United States from starting a nuclear war. They may also want to use a nuclear arsenal to deter other things, which I'll get to. Russia's nuclear weapons are a critical part of Russia's military bureaucracy, particularly land-based ICBMs, which are the Strategic Rocket Forces, which is its own branch of the Russian Armed Forces, right? So where our ICBMs belong to the Air Force, their ICBMs belong to themselves. It's also a really big industry. Labs, manufacturing plants, just there are a lot of jobs associated with Russian nuclear weapons, and that's an important thing to also remember. Most of this is really about strategic nuclear weapons. I'll talk a little bit about non-strategic nuclear weapons, but again, for most Russians, when they're thinking about this, where their minds go is the strategic systems. Okay, so let's start with nuclear deterrence. Russian views of nuclear deterrence have evolved over the last 25 years, and it's worth unpacking how they've evolved because it's an interesting story. So really quickly, Russia inherits the Soviet Union's nuclear arsenal at a time when it's conventionally quite weak and security situations very unsettled. As a result, it actually, for a number of years in the 90s, has a stated doctrine that publicly relies on nuclear weapons to deter pretty much anything, conventional or nuclear. There was debate at the time about just how credible a threat this was. I mean, is this a real deterrent? But Moscow did very intentionally in 1993 drop the Soviet Union's pledge of no first use of nuclear weapons. And there was a lot of debate about it. A lot of people were really uncomfortable with it and really wanted to see Russia build up its conventional forces. Others felt differently and actually thought of this as a pretty cheap way to keep the country safe. And in the late 90s, this turned into a fairly public fight between the defense minister, Igor Sergeyev, and the general staff chief at the time, Anatoly Kvashnin, who had both come into those posts Sergeyev came from the Strategic Rocket Forces, which he had headed before, And not surprisingly, where you stand depends on where you sit, felt that nuclear weapons could make up for conventional weakness and were an ultimate deterrent. Kvashnin wanted to see more spending on the rest of the force, especially ground forces, which was his home. In 99, it looked like Sergeyev had won. Russian rhetoric and discussion emphasized nuclear weapons, including what in the current narrative, if you today, you might see as a de-escalatory strike. The idea in deterrence theory, every strike is de-escalatory. I mean, this is part of the problem with this narrative, right? If you're doing something to, and you're trying to keep somebody else from doing it, everything you do is in principle de-escalatory. But the idea is that you would have low-grade use to try to convince the adversary that you're serious and back off. And in June 1999, there was a military exercise up at 99, which seemed to model Russian nuclear strikes on enemy territory in order to stop a conventional opponent. And then in January of 2000, Russia actually issued a doctrine which said that it allowed for the use of all available forces and assets, including nuclear, in the event of need to repulse armed aggression if all other measures of resolving the crisis situation have been exhausted and have proven ineffective. And then the tide shifts. And it's interesting because the timelines don't quite work, but I do think part of it was a response to the Zapad 99 exercise, which Boris Yeltsin apparently walked out of going, wait, this isn't right. The de-escalation, such as it is rhetoric, kind of goes away. It stays in the doctrine, right? The doctrine doesn't change, but officials start talking pretty strictly about nuclear weapons as intended to deter nuclear use only, particularly a U.S. first strike. And the Strategic Rocket Forces get demoted from being a service to a branch, and Sergeyev gets fired as defense minister. This rhetoric sticks around in about that form through the 2000s, but conventional military reform doesn't actually move forward that quickly. There isn't a real impetus to conventional military reform until after the war in Georgia in 2008. And in 2010, there were indications that Russia was actually planning to drop its nuclear threshold further, the threshold for nuclear use. There was an exercise that seemed to test the use of a nuclear weapon, and the Security Council Secretary at the time, Patrushev, made some comments at the end of 2009 about the forthcoming doctrine that said it was going to allow for preventative nuclear strikes and nuclear use in regional, local, and large-scale war. But then the doctrine came out, and it didn't say that. In fact, it seemed to raise the threshold for nuclear use. It said that nuclear weapons were only for deterrence of existential threats, which is interesting. I mean, what that says to me is that there was a bureaucratic fight, that there are people who think different things in Russia, just as there are people who think different things in the United States. And one group thought it had won, and it turned out that it hadn't. And then we saw this pattern repeat again just a few years ago when we found out there was a new doctrine coming out in 2014. And around that time, there'd been a lot of, you know, what we were looking at as Russian brinksmanship, right? It was after Ukraine, and Russians were talking a lot about their nuclear capabilities. And there were these oblique comments and threats and exercises that seemed to suggest nuclear use. But it's notable that, again, the doctrine that was issued basically repeated the same language as before and also talked for the first time about the need to develop non-nuclear deterrence, which I've seen a few people translate as pre-nuclear. That is not what it says. It's non-nuclear. It's about conventional forces. So, and indeed, and just very recently, in the dish, we still hear the nuclear saber rattling, but we also hear Russia's defense minister, Shoigu, saying things about how Russia needs to evolve away from nuclear deterrence. Now, some people think that Russia still has a strategy that would involve nuclear use in a crisis. And look, secret strategies and things, you know, I can't speak to them. I do not hold a Russian security clearance. I'll say this. One of the biggest reasons that I don't think that Russia actually has this strategy is because there are Russian analysts and former military types and serving military types who keep arguing that it should. My guess is they wouldn't argue that it should if it was actually the policy. So that's, you know, I mean, we can disagree and we can all continue to look for evidence. I would say that if Russia was really looking to lower its nuclear threshold, it would be investing in non-strategic forces. Until very recently, it wasn't doing that at all. And even in those exercises that you see that seem to suggest a lower nuclear threshold, what you're seeing is the use of bombers, strategic bombers. And the investment you are seeing now, it's not really in non-strategic nuclear forces. It's in dual-capable systems, right? And at some level, anything is dual-capable. You can put a nuke on anything and make it a nuclear weapon, a nuclear delivery system. So, you know, when you talk about Iskanders, there's this interesting dynamic here, which is that this is a system that was in development since the 90s. Nobody was really talking about the fact that it could be dual-capable until around 2008. And Westerners pick it up first. And then the Russians go, oh, you seem to be nervous about this. How interesting. Why, yes, they can be nuclear. I think this is kind of an important thing to think about. This isn't to say that everything that Russia does makes a ton of sense. I mean, I think it's important to kind of look at how Russia builds its weapons and how Russia talks about them and recognize the discontinuities between these. I've got like 10 seconds, so I'm just going to very quickly say that Russia puts a lot of emphasis on these land-based ICBMs. I have a suspicion that has something to do with Strategic Rocket Forces still being a branch of the armed forces in its own right. But that also feeds into Russia's rhetoric on things like missile defense, which I've noticed is faith-based in both the United States and Russia. The United States has long insisted that it's building towards a threat from third parties that doesn't exist yet, and Russia is insisting the United States is building a system that isn't now but will eventually be capable of threatening Russia's deterrent. But the assumption there is that of a U.S. first strike that eliminates enough of Russia's land-based missiles, honestly, that the small amount left won't be able to overcome missile defenses. I'm going to stop there. I think I can talk a little. I can talk about things like INF and how Russia is building its systems now in arms control if folks want to do it in the Q&A. But since I don't want to take other people's time, I'm going to pause here.
Thank you.
Anya.
Sure.
Thank you so much to the American Security Project for organizing this event. Thank you all for coming. I see there's a lot of expertise in the room, so I think I'll make sure that I'll be brief and not stand between us and the Q&A. I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the RAND Corporation, so the usual disclaimer here is that everything I say is my personal opinion. And I was asked to briefly talk about the challenges and opportunities of U.S.-Russian engagement on nuclear materials security and nonproliferation. So I think my goal is going to be to just give you some threads to pull on during the discussion if there's interest. So the first point that I wanted to make is that we've come to an end of an era on nuclear materials security cooperation between the United States and Russia, and we're right now at a fork in the road. So bilateral non-Luger cooperative threat reduction, which has been the meat and potatoes, if you will, of U.S.-Russian strategic engagement for about a quarter of a century is now over. And we also have this legacy of multilateral summitry. So you saw that obviously during the Obama administration with the nuclear security summits, but you also had similar things during the Bush and Clinton administration with G7 and G8. And those efforts have been successful, and they've prioritized these efforts to secure materials and counter nuclear terrorism. But it doesn't look like nuclear materials security is going to be a high-level political priority in the coming administration, or maybe in the administration after that as well. And I think we can talk about next steps in the nuclear security summit process in the International Atomic Energy, if you guys want, during the discussion. But during the last administration, there was this opportunity for the two countries to transform their donor-recipient relationship on nuclear materials security into a true partnership. And so there's an opportunity now to build from scratch because those efforts failed. But I would argue that it's advisable for U.S. interests to build from scratch, but it's also not going to be easy. And the reason it's not going to be easy is because there's a fundamental divergence in U.S. and Russian interests when it comes to nuclear materials security. And one of the things you saw after the Ukraine conflict began was that the United States limited nuclear cooperation only to issues that it was interested in, and then Russia reciprocated by limiting its cooperation with the United States to issues that only Russia was interested in, and in effect, all cooperation halted. So Washington has traditionally been much more interested in focusing on issues that, like nuclear security and illicit nuclear trafficking. Obviously, the United States and Russia have the world's largest stockpiles of fissile materials in their both in their military and civilian stockpile sectors. And given the history of cooperative threat reduction, there's a degree of stability and predictability if both sides reduce their fissile material stockpiles, and also if they have insights into their respective approaches to nuclear material security as well as their nuclear security cultures, and also if they're cooperating on reducing the threat of illicit trafficking or nuclear terrorism. But Moscow doesn't think that you can just cooperate on nuclear security and have that be a sustainable relationship. And I think they're much more interested in something that's a bigger basket that includes cooperative engagement on peaceful nuclear technologies. And a lot of its internal effort on nuclear material security has been involved dealing with legacy Soviet nuclear infrastructure problems, so pruning its research reactor fleet and dealing with remediation, as well as obviously developing nuclear technologies. So this is reactor designs and other fuel cycle work that it could, you know, leverage for commercial benefit. So there are areas where the two countries can cooperate with their mutual interests in mind. And there's a recent report by the Nuclear Threat Initiative and the Moscow-based Center for Energy and Security Studies that has this interesting menu of cooperation on nuclear science, safety, security, as well as peaceful nuclear technologies. And I strongly agree with the argument that's laid out in that report that the US and Russia have a special responsibility to work together to reduce the threat of unauthorized use that results from their fissile material stockpiles. So when we talk about US-Russian nuclear cooperation, I think a related issue here that's very important to bring up is the decline of the US ability to compete in terms of exporting nuclear reactors as well as provide fuel cycle services. And the industry perspective here is that the United States, if the United States wants to continue to have an important voice in the global nuclear order, if you will, in the future, we need to make investments now in terms of domestic peaceful nuclear uses. And I think there's a value to having that conversation, whatever your opinion is on nuclear generally, about this, you know, the importance of US nuclear leadership and what we want that to look in the future. What we want that to look like in the future. And also, in the wake of the demise of the Plutonium Management and Disposition Agreement, and we can talk about that in the Q&A, I think also it's important to point out that both the United States and Russia need to minimize their fissile material stockpiles, even if this is done unilaterally, which I understand both countries are committed to doing. But it's preferable also to do it in a way that engages international stakeholders, like the International Atomic Energy Agency. And now with regard to nonproliferation, I'm going to state the obvious, that having more countries with nuclear weapons is dangerous to both US and Russian interests. And we can talk about Iran or North Korea in the Q&A if there's interest as well. But I'll just say that as the United States is embarking on modernization of our nuclear triad, I think it's imperative to also think about what vision, positive vision, do we have for the global nuclear order, if you will. And as you may know, in October of last year, the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly voted to begin negotiations on a ban of nuclear weapons. And those negotiations are going to begin soon. And so, as you know, this move was largely driven by impatience of the non-nuclear weapon states with their nuclear weapon states counterparts with regard to this progress on their disarmament obligations, as you know, most of the world sees it. And so this vision that we have as Americans for the global nuclear order needs to, at the very least, sustain the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And I think there's a great paper by Lou Dunn for Lawrence Livermore's Center on Global Security Research that puts forward this concept of looking long and throwing short. And I think he has this idea of, you know, if we think of a world in 2045 where we seek to eliminate nuclear weapons as instruments of statecraft, but they're still present there, we're not completely abolishing them yet or dismantling and eliminating. And then as a part of that vision, we have short-term initiatives. Some of them could include, you know, arms control with Russia and a lot of other nuclear security efforts. And I think something like that is worth considering. But I think as we move to modernize, we need to think about what that means for the rest of the world and how we comprehensively think about this issue. And so to conclude, I'll just say I think in light of all of this, there is an even greater need for US and Russian constructive and positive leadership on nonproliferation and arms control at this point in time. And there's obviously a long history of formal coordination and informal collusion between the two countries on strengthening institution and other cooperation mechanisms with the goal of reducing the danger of nuclear conflict or unauthorized nuclear use. And I think this is the realm of statesmen and high politics, and it's all very cool. And I would argue that it's also incredibly relevant and important.
Thank you. Before I turn it over to the audience for Q&A, I want to throw out a question to our panelists. And it's along the lines of something that you, Colonel Roberts, mentioned in your remarks, and that's with regards to predictability and uncertainty. Is given the current situation and the state of the New START Treaty, which ASP is firmly in support of, how do we address those issues when it comes to nuclear weapons? How do we create more predictability, more stability, less uncertainty, so that we prevent something like a nuclear disaster or accidental launch from occurring, or some form of escalation that leads us to the brink of something that I don't think anybody in this room would prefer we go down.
Well, I guess I can start. I think that's an excellent question, because part of the unpredictability and uncertainties are our failure to effectively communicate are the nuclear deterrence mission and our nuclear capabilities. That's one of the areas that I think the NATO alliance had fallen down on, and I'll just give you an example. Is that a course that I set up at the NATO school in Oberammergau, Germany. We had one day where we brought in officers, generals and flat admirals from all over the alliance for a one-day course, if you will, on NATO's nuclear deterrence posture. And after I finished my introductory speech, a German two-star general raised his hand and said, "I didn't even know we had nuclear weapons. U.S. had nuclear weapons in Europe. I thought they were a Cold War relic." Now, if a German general didn't even know that, that says a lot about what, you know, we're falling down in our ability to educate the publics so they have a broader understanding of, you know, what exactly is there and what is its mission and what are we doing. And then the other aspect that makes it even more difficult is, in this multifaceted world, the deterrence message has to be crafted for a particular competitor or adversary, if you will, that may be different from what you would do to, say, somebody else. So what you're telling and showing to Russia, for example, could be radically different potentially from what you're trying to show to North Korea or another country that you are reminding them of the costs of aggression that would occur. So the strategic, what we now call a strategic communications package that provides the, you know, responses to the challenges that these other nations give, I think is really, really critical. I've been proposing for the last 6 years the creation of a center of excellence on deterrence, in which that would be its mission to train government officials, military, educate the public, provide information to allies and partners, and respond to public questions about things related to the nuclear mission. The other side, the one that keeps it emphasized within the alliance, is that the nuclear umbrella is a very strong non-proliferation message to our allies, many of which have potentially nuclear capabilities, or certainly have the infrastructure within a very short time they could achieve a nuclear capability. They don't do that, and they aren't pursuing it because of the assurances on the part of the United States, and that's a very powerful message as well. So, yeah, that is one of the gaps that we really need to address very strongly in this multifaceted, uncertain, very dangerous world where we don't know where the next war is going to be.
New start and stability and limiting uncertainty. Look, I think arms control is crucial to stability and limiting uncertainty. I think verification mechanisms embedded in treaties like New Start are a particularly excellent way of giving everyone a certain sense that the other guy isn't breaking rules. I think there are a lot of things I worry about in terms of unstable force postures from the Russian on the Russian side that can only be addressed through arms control. When I look at, the Russian propensity is to build more and more land-based missiles. Land-based missiles are not as survivable. I do think it's a combination of bureaucracy and industry that helps drive that. As we know in our own world, it's kind of hard to constrain that without a legal requirement. And I'd argue some of the same might apply to our missile defense tendencies, where we build things that may not actually work, but they cost a lot of money and they deliver a lot of jobs, and there's a lot of argument for them, so it can be hard to constrain them without getting everybody a little bit handcuffed. So I think I agree that it's about communication, about listening, about... if you don't have channels of communication, you run a very strong risk that your signals will not be understood. You have to not just send signals, but you have to be able to explain them. And arms control has, between the United States and Russia at least, always been a fairly useful way of communicating. And look, when you start the conversation, both sides can put things on the table, and the other side will necessarily, as part of the negotiating posture, say, no way. And then you start talking. And I do think that if we want to limit uncertainty and enhance predictability, those are conversations we have to be having. And in the short term, we need to make sure that New START can stick around, since it is going to, you know, it enters into force very soon, then expires very soon after that, yeah. Unless we make an agreement to extend it. So it's this is a near-term issue.
Anya, did you want to comment?
Very briefly, I'll just say that I think both countries need to keep reducing their fissile material stockpiles and do that in a way that's transparent.
With that, we've got about 15 minutes for Q&A, so we've got a roving mic, which we'll pass around in just a moment here.
I think you lost it. Oh.
And the gentleman right here. I'll get you next.
I'm Rafael Leal with the Brazilian Embassy. So my question would be about North Korea. Suppose I'm the U.S. government, I go to China and ask their help to squeeze the Pyongyang government. They're the only ones that can do that. And China would think, why would I help the collapse of a government that with the collapse, I can see a unification of the Korean Peninsula with a nuclear weapon that is going to be an ally of the U.S.? So how can the U.S. change the calculus of China to, or is there anything that the U.S. can do to persuade China to help impose sanctions on North Korea if it seems to be that it's not their interest to do so?
And I would add to that, is there a role for Russia to play on increasing pressure on China?
Well, we don't have too many NATO forces over North South Korea right now, but I was in my military career. I was participated and was part of the negotiating team for the what became the 1994 agreed framework with the North Koreans. I have to say, the North Koreans were the most difficult people I've ever had to deal with in a negotiating posture. It was quite an interesting experience. There was actually a book written, I think, in 1954 called How Communists Negotiate, and it's a blueprint for how they negotiate even today. So, but you know, we have this process of six nations plus North Korea that hasn't gone anywhere for several years, and this was the effort of the nations around there: China, Russia, the United States, Japan, etc., to enter into a negotiation that we could eventually get to the point where we could eliminate the North Korea's nuclear program, and then also, of course, their concerns over their ballistic missile program. We didn't even bother to mention, of course, it's now quite prominent, their chemical and biological programs, which is also quite fulsome and very, very dangerous. So you got to watch your back and your in the airport. You know, we've always said that China is the key to this, to trying to resolve the North Korea problem. I don't know how many more sanctions you can put on North Korea that would make any difference whatsoever. And you know, getting China to put pressure, and I think they have started to do that actually, where we might be able to create a situation where this particular Kim Jong-un would be willing to go to the negotiating table and to, you know, develop a treaty, agreement, framework, however you want to call it, that we could eventually eliminate this threat. All the indications for me, though, is this is an individual who's bound and determined, building a submarine-launched missile capability. I think it's very dangerous. Of course, the nuclear program and the continued threats and posturing and the things that he does, you know, very... your classic picture of a rogue state, and in, you know, the some 20 odd years since 1994, and looking at all the options, I think we're still at this point of, you know, waiting for, hoping that China will be the key to this problem. I don't see the U.S. as being the key to starting this process. We'll certainly be a player in it, but I don't think that that we'll be able to do much more.
Can a gentleman right here?
Hello, I'm William. I'll be making a trip to Russia in May, aimed at doing citizen-to-citizen discussions, breaking down stereotypes we have about each other. Given that President Trump will be talking to America today, turning to cost savings, would if President Trump was able to negotiate with President Putin to reduce our nuclear weapons by 5,000 weapons each over the next year, what kind of cost implications would that have in terms of cost savings for both us and Russia?
So I have not done the math on this, so I am not going to comment without having done the math. What I will say is that you're not going to get a treaty that's going to reduce nuclear arsenals by 5,000 within a year.
No.
That's just the time. I mean, you might get a treaty within a year, but you won't get that. I mean, that's not the reductions tend to take longer and be a bit more complicated. So, I mean, yeah, I'll leave that there. I don't know if anybody else has anything to add.
Well, I'll comment and say that we were discussing earlier, you know, the projected costs, at least in terms of nuclear modernization for the United States, have ranged over the next 10 years from, I've seen estimates from $400 billion to about $1 trillion. So there's a significant opportunity for savings, but as was just mentioned, I don't think we're going to see that level of reduction over the next number of years.
I also don't think that reduction means you don't modernize, right? So,
certainly, yeah.
I will just say that I think as we think about arms control, it's important not to talk about numbers, but also talk about the predictability and the stability that we have because of our monitoring and verification. And I think that's the most important part to preserve as Russians continue modernizing and as we think about modernizing. So.
Questions in the back.
Hi, my name is Bruce Slaughter, formerly of DOE. My question is, how can the Trump administration approach issues that you discussed, such as classical nuclear arms control negotiations, revamping perhaps the nonproliferation cooperation bilaterally, given the elephant in the room, the situation that Russia and its annexation of Crimea and its failure to move out on Minsk II with Donbass. So with the Ukrainian issue, how can the Trump administration move forward? And the other question I have has to do with some of the non-strategic deployments that's been in the news, the deployment of the Iskander-M and perhaps its new cruise missile. If you can comment on really what sort of a threat that poses or whether that's in that category of dual-capable force that you mentioned, I think, a little earlier.
Okay, so I guess I would say that, if anything, the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea underlines the importance of negotiating. You don't stop negotiating because relations are problematic. You have a much greater imperative to negotiate when relations are problematic. We don't have to negotiate a lot of things with the United Kingdom. I would say that this is important. I would also argue that concerns about implementation of Minsk II do raise questions about negotiating in good faith and underline the importance of verification. There is no evidence of the Iskander being deployed as a nuclear system. You show me evidence of the Iskander being deployed as a nuclear system, we'll have a very different conversation. But right now, what I'm seeing is the deployment of a capable, modernized, modern system that's been in the works for a really long time, that's finally coming off the assembly line. I think we need to think about it in the terms of what it is. We need to think about it in kind of the a 2AD context in terms of just what are we concerned about and what sorts of conflicts are we trying to deter on the conventional side. Question of Russia's INF violation. I worry about is that all of this does weaken the overall arms control framework. That if we're seeing violations that don't get addressed, that don't get fixed, and, by anybody, right? Russia, we have some examples of. But what concerns me is that if Moscow and Washington aren't committed to arms control and aren't committed to their treaties, and the commitment means you abide by them and you follow the rules, and if you're going to withdraw, you withdraw formally rather than violate, then I don't know how we move forward on arms control, and I get really scared.
Yeah. I just add that, in the New START treaty, one of the follow-on was to be on non-strategic nuclear weapons, and the Russians have signaled very strongly that they're not interested, and they would be interested only if, number one, the U.S. removes all of its nuclear weapons out of Europe, number two, that we include the British and French nuclear forces, and number three, that we have discussions on outer space arms control, and then deal with this ballistic missile issue as well. And oh, by the way, in case you don't know it, Europe does have a ballistic missile system. It's the interceptors around Moscow. The Russians are firm believers in missile defense. They just don't like the one that we're trying to put in as well. The alliance made, they suspended, after the invasion of Crimea, they suspended the NATO-Russia dialogue. And I commend to you the Warsaw Pact communique, and about as strong a statement as you could ever make about, we're not doing business with you until you reform yourself. And as just, I'll quote here, Russia has breached the values, principles, and commitments which underpin the NATO-Russia relationship, as outlined in the 97 basic document of Euro-Atlantic Partnership Council, the 97 NATO-Russia Founding Act, and the 2002 Declaration, broken the trust at the core of our cooperation, and challenged the fundamental principles of the global and Euro-Atlantic security architecture. Russia's destabilizing actions and policies include the ongoing illegal and illegitimate annexation of Crimea, which we do not and will not recognize, and which we call on Russia to reverse, the violation of sovereign borders by force, the deliberate destabilization of eastern Ukraine, large-scale snap exercises contrary to the spirit of the Vienna document, and provocative military activities near NATO borders, including in the Baltic and Black Sea regions, and the eastern Mediterranean. Its irresponsible and aggressive nuclear rhetoric, military concept and underlying posture, and its repeated violations of NATO allied airspace. And this is 27 heads of state and government that made this statement. So we have a long way to go.
And if you're curious about Russian violations of airspace, you should check out our website. We've actually got a really cool Russia tracker, essentially, that tracks not only violations of airspace, but also land incursions and incidents at sea, and it's all on a Google Maps-based system. It's really interactive, so I encourage you to check it out. Gentleman right here.
Hello, I'm Daniel Robinson, a freelance writer. I was wondering what possibility could the Iran nuclear deal have in terms of maybe fostering some greater cooperation between Moscow and the United States when it comes to not only non-proliferation but also nuclear security. I mean, so far the deal seems to be holding up, despite some concerns about Iranian violations, as well as the fact that the current administration isn't really that big of a fan of the deal itself. But what kind of possibilities that the Iran deal could possibly have for maybe trying to restart an atmosphere of nuclear engagement between Moscow and Washington?
I will just say very briefly that this was a news cycle several weeks ago, so let's not make it today's news cycle. We kind of forgot about the Iran nuclear deal. Let's not talk about it anywhere that needs to be talked about. But I think I will say that don't forget this is a deal not just involving the United States and Russia. It's a deal involving the Chinese. EU 3+3 or the P5+1. So there's multiple countries that were invested for a very long time into making this agreement happen and enforcing it. And I think it's true that the United States and Russia both had very important roles to play. So the Russians were the only ones who were engaged in nuclear energy cooperation with Iran, and the United States was the only country who could credibly promise to relieve the sanctions on Iran, right? So there was important roles for both countries to play, but I think that that deal, if anything, highlights the fact that you're going to need, increasingly going forward, much more multilateral solutions for these very, very difficult cases. So, and I think, again, the agreement provides monitoring of Iran's nuclear program, and I think that is important. So.
Got time for one more. This gentleman in the back.
Hi, Alex Bernard. Alex Bernard from the Nuclear Initiative. So I want to give a quick thanks to Dr. Fink for giving a shout out to our recently released report on cooperation and potential pathways to that. My question is for all three of you, I guess, based on reducing uncertainty and building cooperation and trying to avoid nuclear risk. It was in the news recently that, I think it was last week, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff met with his Russian counterpart in Baku, Azerbaijan. And I wanted to ask about what importance do y'all place on military-to-military communication, and to what extent do you think that this current political climate will foster the continuation of that kind of communication and cooperation?
Great question.
Well, I'm absolutely for it. It's one of the best ways to go. When I first went to NATO in 2005, you may not believe this, but we were actually in discussions with the Russians on a program to make them a member of NATO. So we've obviously gone a long way in the opposite direction of where we were planning on going. I chaired the Nuclear Committee. Also, I chaired the Theater Missile Defense Committee. We had great cooperation with the Russians on theater missile defense from 2005 to 2007. Very technical issues, but there was great cooperation. On the nuclear side, we developed a program, a plan of action, a program that really encompasses almost all the confidence-building measures you could possibly think of. Exchanges with military officers, observance of military exercises, observance of your response capabilities in the event of terrorist incidents with a weapon of mass destruction. We had over a dozen pages of programmed events that enhanced our understanding of each other's capabilities. We even had some of the most open and candid discussions on nuclear doctrine with the Russians, in which Russia, the United States, France, and the UK made presentations on the nuclear policies and doctrines of the nuclear weapon states and had discussions about that. The only thing the Russians would not discuss was non-strategic nuclear weapons at the time. So, and I felt that we were really making great progress. Some of the exercises, the first exercise we did on a nuclear incident, the Russians volunteered for that. And so we had that exercise along with several others. But slowly that relationship eroded, starting in 2007 with the cyber attack of Estonia, the 2008 attack on Georgia, and then, of course, the rest of the events, which we're all very familiar with, to the point where now we don't have any working relationship within the alliance with Russia anymore. So. But I thought that those exchanges were extremely useful. They got to be a very good working relationship with the Russian general that was responsible for their nuclear forces. But that ended. So, again, I'm all in favor of that.
Can I just very briefly add that I think there's a very important role, and if you read sort of a lot of excellent work during the Cold War in the 1980s that was done on sort of the Incidents at Sea Treaty and sort of other discussions about the importance of, you know, prudent principles in terms of force interactions, conventional force interactions between Russia and U.S. NATO, as well as, you know, principles of due regard when it comes to airspace. And I think there's a lot of proposals out there, I think, in various fora that are not just mil-to-mil, but also sort of civ-mil. And so I think a lot of that stuff needs to pay, you know, we need to pay much greater attention to it, especially here in Washington.
I am also for military engagement. I mean, as I already said, I think if you want to send signals, being able to actually talk directly is a very good way of making sure that your signals are understood.
Great. I'd like to have the audience thank our panelists for appearing with us today. And as I mentioned before, check out our website, AmericanSecurityProject.com. If you're feeling generous, we do have a donate, sorry, .org. We do have a donate button if you like the programming that you saw today and we'd like to continue it. So thank you all for coming.